Mr. Jesse, do you have further questions?
No further questions at this time.
Okay, redirect?
Yes, I have a couple of questions for Mr. Levitas on redirect. And Mr. Levitas, I'll begin with a line of questioning that Ms. Cummings had asked you about the stakeholder process and your having raised the catch-22 problem and potential solutions. And I believe that Ms. Cummings stated that that you raised this catch-22 problem late in the stakeholder process. It consisted of approximately 17 meetings. Do you recall your testimony about that?
I do.
And can you describe for the commission the focus of the stakeholder process, whether it was primarily focused, the length of time primarily focused on the state jurisdictional Q reform stakeholder process or the FERC jurisdictional Q reform process?
The vast majority of meetings were devoted to the state process.
And the vast majority of time and number of meetings?
Yes.
And then you were also asked by Ms. Cummings about whether the public staff provided any specific feedback to your solution to the catch-22 problem during the stakeholder process. Do you recall that exchange?
Yes.
And I think that your response was is during the stakeholder process that you did not, the public staff did not provide any actual feedback. Is that correct?
That's correct.
After the stakeholder process, can you describe to the commission the conversations and information that was provided to the public staff about the conditional CBCN application before it was filed?
Well, to be honest, I don't recall all that sequence of events. I don't know if you have a document that would refresh my recollection. I did mention that the email that, and again, I'm not remembering which was the exhibit and which was the one that I discovered. I guess the exhibit to my testimony was some record that right in that same time frame I was seeking to confirm with public staff their position as to how this would work so that it would be successful.
And subject to check, we filed the conditional CBCN application on July the 12th of 2021. Does that sound accurate?
It does.
And do you recall whether we had any virtual meetings with the public staff shortly before filing the conditional CBCN application?
I'm certainly aware that we were seeking to give the public staff a heads up of what we were planning, and you may refresh my recollection, but I've had so many conversations and Zoom calls with the public staff on these topics that they run together a little bit.
And subject to check, would you agree that we provided a copy of the conditional CBCN application to the attorneys for the public staff before we filed it?
We did.
And do you recall whether we asked for feedback from the public staff about the conditional CBCN application?
I'm sure that's why we provided it to them.
And do you recall whether we received any feedback from the public staff?
I don't recall receiving any feedback.
And then, Mr. Levitas, you were also asked by Ms. Cummings about whether it would be possible or preferable for Juno Solar to participate in DISIS as opposed to the transitional cluster study. And you provided some information about some benefits, some public benefits that would be provided to the state based upon solving constraints in southeastern North Carolina by participating in the transitional cluster study. Are there any other benefits to the state or to the ratepayers for Juno participating in the transitional cluster study as opposed to DISIS?
Well, I am very concerned that if Juno does not participate in the cluster study or is required to withdraw after phase one because it doesn't have certainty around the CPCN, that the transitional cluster study will implode. At a minimum, if it has to withdraw, there will almost certainly have to be restudy. But my main concern, as I think I said during Cross, is that it's vitally important to spread the upgrade costs in this critical region of the state over as many megawatts as possible in order for any project to be able to absorb them. So, if Juno is able to pick up a portion of those costs, it means that other state jurisdictional projects will have a lower share of the costs and potentially be viable and able to get these costs done. And the biggest concern that I have for the ratepayers and the public interest is that if these upgrades are not made feasible as a result of the transitional cluster study, first of all, I have no idea what's going to happen in DISIS, but there's a very good chance that they won't get resolved in DISIS either. And then we're really in a mess. And I also would just point out that in the transitional cluster, there are quite a number of state jurisdictional projects, including ones controlled by our company, that will bear their share of those upgrade costs. One of the objections in the Friesian proceeding, a major objection, was that there were going to be state projects that effectively would be free riders because the FERC jurisdictional project would be reimbursed for all the costs. That was one of the benefits and beauties of the transitional cluster study, is that those state projects would not get a free ride. They would have to bear their costs. Admittedly, there would be some FERC jurisdictional projects that would get reimbursement, but that was certainly a big improvement over the situation that was presented by Friesian. And I would argue it's a big improvement over what would be likely to happen if the transitional cluster study doesn't work. Because my belief is if the transitional cluster study is not successful, that these upgrades will eventually get done and they will be 100% paid for by North Carolina ratepayers. So there's an opportunity here, if the transitional cluster can be successful, to spread some of those costs to state jurisdictional projects, including ones that we control, and we're quite prepared to pay our share of those costs.
And finally, Mr. Levitish, you just testified that if the transitional cluster is not successful and the qualifying facilities do not pay their fair share and pay 100% of the network upgrade costs that are assigned to them, that the ratepayers will likely end up paying for the cost of the network upgrades. Can you explain, especially in light of House Bill 951, how that might work or what the concern is?
Well, I think we were talking earlier about competitive procurement under 951. Those rules have, of course, not been established, but my expectation is that, as with House Bill 589, that where projects are competitively procured, that it is in ratepayer interest to for any upgrade cost to be paid by ratepayers rather than be embedded in PPA bid prices. But also keep in mind that 55% of all solar projects that will be procured under House Bill 951 will be owned by the utility, and by definition, their upgrades will be paid for by ratepayers.
Thank you, Mr. Levitish. That's all the questions I have.
Okay, commission questions?
I just have a couple. Mr. Levitish, during one of your exchanges with Ms. Cummings, I believe you were discussing the value of not establishing firm rules across the board for all projects, but looking at projects on a case-by-case basis and with the best available information, I think was the phrase you may have used. You recall that exchange?
Do.
Let me ask you this question. Would we not be in a position, better position, to know what the estimates are on transmission upgrade costs at the end of the phase one cluster study? We would know what Duke's estimate was, phase one estimate, understanding that that's subject to phase two study, but we would also know their initial estimate of what would be allocated to the Juno project, and what would be allocated to other projects, and how many other projects might be bearing the cost, wouldn't we?
Well, you would, but if
that's information we don't have today.
That's right. I guess I would say two things in response. One is procedurally, it would appear to be very difficult to get projects through the CPCN process between the end of phase one and the time that firm financial commitments have to be made and withdrawal penalties become applicable in phase two. It's a very narrow window. But perhaps more substantively, your question, Commissioner Klotfelter, implies that those total costs or absolute costs are relevant to the decision about the CPCN. And as you know, we've indicated in our testimony, we believe that LCOT is a reasonable test. It's the test that this commission has approved. And you know, let's say that you get this information and there are $100 million of total FERC jurisdictional costs. I don't know how many FERC jurisdictional projects are in the transitional cluster. I know there's some. But let's say you have an absolute, phase one yields an absolute value on those costs. It's my position, our position, that that is not relevant information, not permissible information to consider in denying a siting decision for an individual project, that you're going to deny that siting decision because there are three or four projects over here that have some impact on ratepayers or on the costs. And so we think you've got it. Well, as you know, the Friesian case is on appeal. We have some disagreement about that. But if there is going to be a test, if there is not complete preemption of siting authority, we believe that LCOT is the correct test, that the public staff has stated that, that the commission has relied on it. And as long as you have, and if that's so, as long as you have a condition linked to LCOT, that information, you don't really need to make the decision. Now, you might want to decide, if you don't think $4 is the right number, that's obviously your prerogative to say that's not the right number. But once we get the phase one information, it will either be below whatever number you decide is reasonable in this case or not. And that will decide whether this CPCN remains in effect or dissolves.
Thank you for that answer. Let me ask you a couple of follow-ups. I mean, right now, the only application for CPCN I have before me is this one. So what would be the procedural problem with simply holding the record open on the decision of this CPCN and simply taking into the record the phase one cost estimate for allocation of this project?
I'm going to go out on a limb because I haven't thought about this before, but I want to be responsive to your question. If what you mean is that that you would create a procedure in this docket to issue a CPCN based on a LCOT number, but you just want to wait until you have that information from phase one, and then there would essentially be an immediate issuance, in other words, sort of a condition precedent, so that you had made the decision and
don't put too many ideas into my head, Mr. Levitis. Let me simplify the question for you again. I'm just going back to the idea that more information is better than less information, and today I have no information. I have a proposal that we put a condition in order, but as to what the actual LCOT for this project will be, I have no information right now. So all I'm simply asking you is, what would be wrong with my getting at least one additional bit of information, and that is the phase one estimate, before I make a decision on this petition?
Well, is that going to determine whether you think $4 is the right number?
It would give me an LCOT number on phase one, at which I could look at and say, is that too much or is that not enough, or is that fine? What's the harm in doing that?
Well, to my earlier point, if the CPCN decision can be finalized, well, two things. If the CPCN can be finalized before the phase two commitment has to be made, that would go a long way toward solving the problem. I will say that the posture that we're in right now is not irrelevant, in that we've got to spend $250,000 on study costs. And we also have other costs that are associated. We've already incurred costs of $500,000 or so on this project. And we have to do those going forward without any, in the absence of a conditional CPCN, any guidance, any benchmark, any way of knowing whether we're ultimately going to be able to move this project forward. So we are at a disadvantage. And I guess what I'm missing is understanding how your decision about whether $4 is a reasonable number would be affected as to what, if you come back and the number comes back at $350, or it comes back at 250, how does that change your decision?
Suppose it comes back at $25. Would I not want to know that?
Well, that would kill the CPCN under the condition that we propose.
It would, again, I'm not asking about your proposed conditioning. I'm asking about the information that would be useful to me in deciding whether the costs of this project are too great at this location to warrant issuing a CPCN. Wouldn't it be beneficial for me to have more information rather than less information?
Well, I don't mean to be difficult. I'm just not sure why. You know, if I make a decision that I'm willing to pay $20,000 for a car, and I go into the market, I don't necessarily need to know that whether the car costs 15 or 30, I'm only going to pay 20. So
you seem to be shifting your ground a little bit from where you were with Ms. Cummings. You seem to be suggesting to me now that I just fix the price in advance and simply apply it across the board going forward. If I'll pay $20,000 for that car, I'll pay $20,000 for the next car.
No, let me clarify on that. First of all, I think we may have said this in some testimony. We've accepted the notion that while there may decisions may be informed by prior decisions, we're not asserting that any of this is binding precedential decision making. And the second thing is, with respect to my points, Ms. Cummings, about updated information and the like, the main thing that I want to communicate about that is that LCOT is a test based on market conditions, market benchmarks. And we understand, I acknowledge with Ms. Cummings, those may change over time. And so, but the time frame that we're talking about here is a short time frame. But I understand that you would not want to publish a rule that says LCOT of $4 is okay, and then we find out 2 years from now that the average market LCOT is $1.50. So we're in agreement on that. But I guess what I would hope to see is some general guidance to market participants so they have an idea about what the rules of the road are.
Thank you, that's helpful. Let me ask you one other thing. If I had the phase one estimate and I knew who had been studied in phase one and I knew the total cost that had been allocated to those projects studied in phase one and I knew how much was allocated to your project, then I would have two numbers, would I not? I would know what the number would be allocated in phase one to your project, and then I would know what the maximum number your project might have been assigned if everyone else had dropped out of phase one. I could see the upper bound in phase one too, couldn't I? And I might look at that and say, you know, even at that number, I think it's warranted. I'd have that information too, wouldn't I?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful information. I think that the problem that we face is how do we get to phase two with certainty about our certification so that we don't face a $2.25 million withdrawal penalty because you decide to withdraw or revoke the CPCN at some future time.
I hear you. I understand. Thank you. I have one more question. I have some questions from Ms. Miller, but I'm going to stop with my questions with Mr. Levitas because of the time and then see.
Right.
I have other questions later from Ms. Miller. This is a question purely out of curiosity. So last year in the report from the North Carolina Transmission Planning Collaborative, they reported a special case study on transmission projects that might be required in Cabarrus and Union counties under certain conditions. Has Pine Gate or Juneau or anyone else here in Ottawa ever asked the Transmission Planning Collaborative to conduct a special policy case study on southeastern North Carolina?
Not to my knowledge, but I'm not associated with our transmission planning group. I will say that I was a little surprised, learned in the course of the Friesian litigation, that as I understand it, that transmission planning group really focuses on replacement needs to accommodate age and wear and tear of the system and is not particularly focused on planning to accommodate new growth.
Actually, the Cabarrus and Union study was premised on precisely that. The policy case studies are not simply on replacements or reliability. They're on actually looking ahead under different scenarios of what might be required to bring offshore wind into North Carolina, or in this case, what would happen if growth projections in Cabarrus and Union exceeded current estimates.
Good. Well, I'm glad to know that.
I just was curious if anyone in your group has ever considered drawing upon that resource.
Well, I think we should. I'm not aware. Perhaps we have. I'm just not aware of it.
I'm just thinking about the policy problem you've presented today and thinking about avenues for how to address.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have for you.
Okay, thank you. Do you have questions, Chair Mitchell?
I do. Just a few. Mr. Levitas, talk some about the constitutionality concern that you have. Just help me understand what the legal issue there.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you my belief. My belief is, leaving aside the preemption issue that's on appeal, that I thought it was generally recognized, certainly by the public staff, I've had these conversations with public staff, that this commission, any state commission, cannot say permissibly, constitutionally, that we simply don't like the federal policy and we're going to refuse to acknowledge it and we're going to deny a permit for any project that would benefit from it. And that instead, and what I believe you undertook to do in Frisian, was to say what we can do is, as part of our siting authority, and to, I think, Commissioner Klonfelter used some of these words, can make a decision about whether we think a particular project is appropriately cited in light of the cost that it would impose on the system and the ratepayers. So anything that to me amounts to an absolute ban on FERC jurisdictional projects in the state of North Carolina because of a blanket objection to the crediting policy, I think is really problematic.
Okay, and is that's the constitutional concern of which you speak in regards to the public staff's position on LCOT?
Yes.
Okay. Just a few more for you. Can you help me understand the transitional cluster? How is it going to work? My understanding is fairly limited, you know, pursuant to that which y'all have put it, which the parties have put in front of us, but it's going to be open for a finite period of time and projects can apply. You've testified today that you're concerned that it could, the transitional cluster could implode. So I need to understand that testimony, and I also want to understand how the transitional cluster is actually going to work in practice.
Sure. So the window has closed. And there's a defined universe of projects that are now in the transitional cluster study. The actual phase one study will begin, can you help me out?
December 1st.
The actual study is going to begin, leading to the phase one power flow results. At that point, the costs that are identified will be allocated to the participants in the cluster study. And they will be advised of their share based on the allocation methodology and the procedures that you approved. And those customers will then elect either to proceed to phase two or to withdraw. If they proceed to phase two, they then become subject to various withdrawal penalties. I have been in regular conversations with Duke throughout the year about the pipeline. And Duke has done a good bit of work to try to analyze the pipeline, including conversations that had since the window closed, all with the goal of trying to determine, do we have a transitional cluster study that will work? Does it look like there are enough megawatts in here that the cost could be spread so we would have a reasonable LCOT for the FERC jurisdictional projects? And so the state jurisdictional projects, which will have to bear their own costs, are getting an allocation that is financially viable. Because if the amount comes back too high for a state project and that project is no longer financeable, it's going to fall out. And so I've tried very hard to confirm that we were on a track for having this thing work. because we've all invested a lot in it. It's really important that it be successful. And at least all the indications that I've gotten is, looks like it could work. We don't know who will drop out when they get their number. Somebody could, you know, their pro rata share could come back at $1 million on a 10 megawatt project, a state jurisdictional project, and the developer could say, I can't handle it, I'm gone. And so what happens is the projects drop out, you reallocate the pie. And of course, the risk is that as projects drop out and other projects get a larger share, that then they in turn won't be able to bear those costs. They drop out too. That's what I refer to as the implosion, the downwards spiral. But the indications that I've had is that if we can keep all of the megawatts that are currently signed up for transitional cluster in the cluster, we have a reasonable chance of getting this thing to work, and that the pro rata allocation to all of these projects will be reasonable, both from the standpoint of what state jurisdictional projects can bear on their own, and within the LCOT kind of parameters of what you all at least have seemed to find acceptable in the past. So I've got my fingers crossed, because it's really important to the state that we make this work.
All right, thank you for that explanation. So help me understand, just keeping in mind that I'm not an engineer, so help me understand how the projects that have the universe of projects, interconnection requests that we now have in the transitional cluster process, how was there any assurance of sort of geographic proximity on the grid? I mean, how do we know that there are going to be projects that actually are clustered that should rightfully or appropriately share in cost?
Well, all that is done as part of the power flow study. All of that is looked at. So,
but in terms of who applied to participate in the transitional cluster?
Right. So Duke will take the universe of all those projects. They will run power flow analysis, assuming all of those projects are coming onto the system and will be onto the system. And they will do interdependency studies. And an important thing to keep in mind is that there's not a single upgrade that's required. There's many upgrades that are required as part of to resolve these constraints. And so some projects may contribute to two of those. Some projects may contribute to six of those. And Duke has a formula that was, again, part of the procedures for how those get allocated among those various projects. But when the dust settles, at the end of phase one, Duke will give a number to each one of those projects and say, here is your pro rata upgrade cost for which you will be responsible if you stay in this transitional cluster. Are you in? And if you raise your hand, say you're in, then you then within a 30 days or some defined period of time have to put up your money to cover the cost of those upgrades.
Okay, and so do we have, what can you tell me about what projects, what is this universe of projects that have elected to participate in the transitional cluster? Are there, that are at least have been studied by Duke?
My understanding is that it's on the order of 1,500 megawatts in the, I'm not sure if that's the full transitional cluster or the ones that are potentially interdependent on the southeast upgrades, but it's a significant number. And Duke has continued to, as I said, to express optimism to me that this could all work. But you know, my sense is it's precarious, and if any significant number of megawatts drop out, there's a real chance that it won't work. You know, one of the other things that I've just said in this context is that if we were to decide with Juno to go ahead and go forward with phase one, even in the absence of a CPCN, and then we come back with a number that's $3, and we're concerned, well, we still don't know what the commission's going to do, that's a little too close for comfort, we better drop out, then there's a real good chance that that's going to throw the whole cluster into, at least into restudy and possibly into non-viability.
Okay, and just so I'm clear, what happens? Follow that through to its logical conclusion, and then what?
Well, um, so as projects, if projects start dropping out because they have too high a share based on phase one, you'll iterate down and see if anybody's left. And if everybody drops out, then nothing happens in transitional cluster. All those projects will now be out of the queue and will have to reapply to the queue for DISIS in the spring. And now we will be back with some new universe of projects back in the same boat with another year of study ahead of us to figure out whether we can make this work the next time around. And, I don't know of any reason to be more optimistic at that stage. I sort of feel like this is the best chance we've got, and we need to take it. We need to be sure we don't lose it. And as I said, I'm particularly concerned about any delays as it relates to 951, because the timeline is so crucial that we get on with the business of adding new non-carbon resources in order to achieve the goals.
Okay, thank you for that additional explanation. You've talked about...
Chairman, can I interrupt just a detail on one question you asked?
Sure.
Of the megawatts that you identified for Chair Mitchell, what proportion of those require CPCNs in South Carolina?
Well, South Carolina only requires CPCNs above 75 megawatts, and I'm not aware that there are a bunch of those.
In that group?
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me.
You've testified about the criticality of southeastern North Carolina as it relates to, you know, meeting the requirements of 951. Help me understand why. I mean, why are you so certain in your testimony that southeastern North Carolina is critical, and solar development in southeastern North Carolina is critical to meeting 951? I mean, solar development is occurring all over the state. There is significant amount occurring in the northeastern portion of the state. It seems to me that solar developers have had success in developing all over the state. Why is this one particular area that has significant transmission congestion critical?
Well, I'm going to ask Ms. Miller to supplement what I say, but what I'll tell you is this. It's a very large area, first of all. It's 13, 15 counties. It is absolutely the best land for doing solar. And once you get into the Piedmont, and certainly beyond, there are huge challenges that are faced in siting solar facilities. Topography, contiguous land availability, population centers, which lead to potential for local opposition or just other issues that have to be addressed. I can tell you that it's been, since CPRE was adopted, where the heavy focus of procurement was in Duke, all the solar developers have been trying to find sites in DEC's territory because that's where CPRE is focused. It is extremely difficult. There are people who really know this business who have been scouring the landscape for years, and what they have come up with is limited and is nowhere near the volume of capacity that is needed to achieve goals of 951. I think Ms. Miller touched on it. The other thing that we really need to be thinking about is the least cost mandate of 951. And in the solar business, least cost means bigger. And it's just basic economy of scale. And the only way that we're going to be able to drive the cost of 951 compliance down for ratepayers is if we build bigger sites. And those can pretty much only be built in the East. You want to add anything?
Yeah, no, I think you covered it very well. I would just also note that most of the facilities that we do see in DEC, as Steve mentioned, are quite a bit smaller. And even within what is participating in the transitional cluster, they tend to be closer to like the 30 to 40, 50 megawatt range. And I would say 50 megawatts, sometimes even on the higher end. Whereas in DEP, you tend to see projects that are able to be quite a bit more sizable and more cost effective from just a land perspective. There tends to be flatter land, better solar irradiance, so we have higher yield, better production in that portion of the state. And also, you know, solar facilities, of course, is very dependent on proximity to infrastructure as well. And we tend to find better parcels of open land with close proximity to the transmission infrastructure needed in the DEP system than we do in the DEC system.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, Mr. Levitas, a couple more for you. As I understand Juno's position in this docket, it would agree to, or it has proposed a conditional CPCN with the $4 sort of being that the threshold above which the CPCN would terminate or become void. And this is something that Juno has proposed and presumably would agree to. Are you aware of the American Beach proceeding at the FERC?
I'm aware that it's pending. I'm not aware of the details.
You're not aware of the nature of the issue before the FERC in American Beach?
Not with any confidence. You might refresh my recollection.
That's okay. I'll just move on.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. I think I understand your testimony about sort of the transitional cluster, how it works with respect to sort of the at least your testimony about the necessity of the 275 megawatts kind of propping up. The development, but you talk about the state jurisdictional projects in the pipeline or in that universe, in the transitional cluster universe, that would absorb their share of or their allocation of upgrade costs. Help me understand the nature of those state jurisdictional projects. Are they QFs?
There's certainly a number of QFs, including ones that we're involved with.
Generally, I don't expect you to know specifically.
Yeah.
But.
In the transitional cluster, I guess there are some potential GSA projects in transitional cluster.
Yeah, they would have several offtake options, but generally there are, I would say, primarily QFs.
Okay, and you're getting at my question, which is who's gonna, what would be the power sale arrangements for these state jurisdictional projects?
Well, they would either be QFs with 5-year PPAs or GSA projects with 20-year PPAs.
Okay.
I guess I should also say that it is possible that a transitional cluster study project could potentially participate in some future competitive solicitation as well.
Okay.
It would not be in the CPRE Tranche 3 because that is going to be studied through a separate resource solicitation cluster. But it's possible that you could have a project come through transitional cluster study and just be ahead of the game in terms of whatever procurement may occur in 2022.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Robitis. I have nothing further.
Okay, looking at the time, we're just gonna move forward with Mr. Levitas and come back to Ms. Miller. So, with respect to this defined universe of projects, do all the participants know who is in this universe, or only Duke?
I don't know whether that information has been made public or is accessible by other parties or not.
There's no information about the owners of the projects, so it should be primarily known by Duke. But presumably, with research, people could put two and two together about the owners.
Okay, and would there be any objection from the parties for the commission to obtain that defined universe of projects from Duke? without sharing with the parties, obviously.
We have no objection, so long as Duke is willing to provide it, but we have no objection.
Public staff has no objection. We will point the commission to public staff, Miller Cross Exhibit 1, which does have the queue, the transition queue projects as of yesterday.
Okay, thank you.
And we do have the list with the names. It's confidential, but we do have that information.
Okay, thank you for that information.
And if I might, Mr. Duffley, I have not seen this exhibit, and it's dated yesterday. So it's possible that there is more current information than what I had when I was responding to Chair Mitchell's questions in terms of the status of the transitional cluster. It looks like there's a lot of information here.
Okay, thank you. And Juno is within this, is this the phase one list of the, so Juno is part of phase one at this point?
Yes, I believe that these.
Mr. Levitt is.
I'm happy to answer.
Yep, Ms. Miller, if you can answer.
Yes, Juno is part of the phase one study. And this should be comprehensive of phase one, although I will note that projects, I believe, had up until November 30th until today to elect to withdraw without penalty. So it's possible that some projects have changed since yesterday.
Okay, and when the study results, as I understand in my review, maybe the study results for phase one will be issued on March 31st, 2022. And how long do the participants have to elect to move into phase two? Is it the full 30 days, or do they have to elect at some time prior to that 30-day period?
My assumption is that you are given 30 days, but there is, Duke has encouraged participants to make an election and post a deposit as quickly as possible so that they are not, you know, working up until the end hour trying to put everything together. So there will likely be motivation and pressure to move forward as quickly as possible within the 30 days.
Okay, thank you. And then, Mr. Levitis, going to your constitutional concerns, as I understand the public staff's concern in looking at all of the projects versus one project is the fact that the process has changed from a first-to-cause to this type of cluster study process. And I just want to throw out a hypothetical to you and then ask you the question. So let's assume many projects are built, state and federal projects, and there's an increase in wholesale rates of 70%. And as you know, that increase will trickle down to retail rates. And public staff is charged with protecting consumers for affordable rates. And not to have overbuild of the system. So I've heard you say that the levelized cost of transmission should be the metric to use, but do you have another suggestion for the commission? Are there any other metrics or any other types of review that the commission can do holistically so that the rates do not rise to an unaffordable level?
I don't have a thought about that off the top of my head. I guess the concern that I expressed is, maybe to reiterate, is the commission has opined in the Friesian case with the support of public staff that in terms of the federalism, the balance of the allocation of authority between federal and state, that the commission retains siting authority with respect to particular projects. And so my thought about that has been that that requires a decision to deny CPCN to be based on information about characteristics of that project, and that it would not be permissible to say, we've just got too many of these federal projects in our state, we're closing our borders and not allowing any more in.
Okay, thank you. And so this is to both of you. In Mr. Metz's testimony, he discusses need. And obviously, we don't have any cost yet. So his interpretation of need is not based upon any type of upgrade cost. So, and the public staff found that the applicant has not made a sufficient showing of need for the facility. And I just wanted to hear what your response is to this determination by the public staff.
Yeah, I think we would disagree. I think we feel there is a significant need for the facility shown by the demand in PJM for solar resources, especially of this size and type that would likely be very cost effective. And of course, we've got the preliminary term sheet executed with a large commercial buyer that indicates their interest, their strong interest in the full output of the facility. And in addition, with the enactment of House Bill 951, as we've mentioned previously, there will be a strong need for substantial additions of solar. And Juneau is not only a solar facility, but also a solar plus storage facility. So it has the capability to provide flexible generation as well, which is an added benefit amongst other ancillary services. And due to its size, and other factors, it is likely the most cost-effective facility to contribute to those goals at this point in time, or one of the most cost-effective facilities. So we see that as several strong avenues for need for the facility.
Okay, thank you. And we may come back to that, but I want to get through staff questions. My fellow commissioners asked most of my questions. So. If Juneau ultimately ends up selling its output to a commercial customer within PJM, the PJM region, there'll be some wheeling that needs to occur, and it's staff's understanding that there would be additional studies regarding how to wheel it, and that would add potentially to additional transmission upgrades. Has Juneau initiated those studies?
Correct. So Juneau would need to work with DEP to conduct a transmission study, which would function very similar to an interconnection study in some ways. We have had preliminary discussions with DEP about that. We intend to initiate a transmission study in the near future. DEP does publish their current available transmission capacity online. And based on what they've published today and in the past, we believe that there should be more than sufficient transmission service available for the Juneau facility. But correct, we would conduct that study to be aware of any requirements there.
Okay, and if there were upgrades that would be needed, would that be part of the levelized cost of transmission?
I don't believe we've discussed that previously, but we have committed to the $4 LCOT cap being inclusive of any system upgrades required in any affected system studies in Duke. So I believe that would be inclusive of those as well.
Okay, thank you. And the next question is, let's assume that the ultimate buyer ends up being DEP. Would it then turn the interconnection agreement, would it become state jurisdictional rather than FERC jurisdictional?
I was under the impression, which may be incorrect because I haven't dealt with the siting and permitting of Duke-owned facilities, but I was under the impression that their facilities were FERC jurisdictional by nature, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Okay.
Commissioner Duffley, while I'm speaking, having not previously seen this Exhibit 7, could I just point out a couple of things to you that seem of interest to my earlier testimony?
You may.
I'm looking at it's a two-sided exhibit, so I guess I'm looking at page 5. And this is information about what's in the transitional cluster, which you were asking about. And I'll just point out a couple of things. First of all, you'll see that the solar projects in DEC and DEP, consistent with what you've heard from Ms. Miller and me, that there's about four times as many projects in DEP as DEC, which is consistent with what we've said about the difficulty in siting projects on the DEC side. In addition, if you look at the DEP breakdown, you'll see that there are roughly 1,300 megawatts of state jurisdictional projects and 735 megawatts of FERC jurisdictional projects, so about 2-to-1 state to federal. So that tells me two things. One is that if things proceed and these FERC jurisdictional projects are able to participate, you will potentially have reimbursement under the crediting policy, but you're getting 2/3 of the cost of these upgrades potentially paid for by parties other than North Carolina ratepayers, which seems very attractive to me. I also would say, just looking at these numbers, where you've got an aggregate in DEP of around 2 gigawatts, I think that is consistent with my suggestion that there's not a lot of margin for error to have a large project drop out with accounting for 10% or more of the total without running a risk that the other projects start spiraling downward. So I just wanted to make those observations. I appreciate you letting me do that.
You're welcome. And my last question's for Ms. Miller, so I'm going to hold that question. Questions on commission questions?
May I also observe, Mr. Levitis, that too, that it answers one of my questions, which is there are two very large FERC jurisdictional projects in South Carolina and the transitional view that aggregate about 14% of the total. Both of them connect to the Florence King Street line. So thank you for getting the answer to my earlier question.
I do have a few questions for Witness Levitis based on Chair Mitchell's questions regarding, you know, transition queue and the purpose of transition queue, and maybe perhaps it would implode if we don't go forward with a conditional CPCN. Your assertion seems to be that the purpose of the transition queue is to resolve the congestion in southeastern North Carolina, but isn't it true that the purpose of the transition queue, as it's been described in, you know, FERC filings, is really that the current serial study process has resulted in numerous delays because we have a lot of high number queued projects that are non-viable and speculative and are holding up the queue so that these lower number viable projects can't be studied, they can't move forward. And this is really a transition mechanism. You have to pick serial or you have to pick transition cluster. You have an option right now. And this process, this first transition, the purpose of it really is to clear the queue so that you can proceed with transitional cluster studies. And if transition queue does not result in, you know, what you're hoping it will result in, which is building the upgrades to resolve this congestion, there is another opportunity in DISIS to do so. In fact, it's probably likely more projects will proceed in DISIS where the withdrawal penalties are lower. Is that a reasonable assumption?
Well, you covered a lot of ground there. let me respond first by saying I would certainly agree that the primary purpose, the reason for queue reform and for the transitional cluster, was to clear the queue, the backlog, move to a more workable, more viable system of interconnection study. And you'll notice from your exhibit that I believe, I just looked at it quickly, I think 13,500 megawatts of projects that were in the queue have dropped out rather than moving forward in the transition process. So it is accomplishing its purpose. That said, recognizing that that process was underway and that we simultaneously have this problem that has related to transmission constraints, every problem related to transmission constraints that we, many of us, including Duke, believe need to be solved. And these were the conversations that we had some time ago. It was perceived, determined, concluded that the best available solution to that problem was to try to create a transition cluster that was sufficient to spread these costs in a way that would be acceptable so that these upgrades could go forward. Your last question to me was about, well, doesn't DISIS do that just as well? And I think there are a couple of problems with that. One is timing. We will, if we don't get this problem solved now, we will lose a year, and we can't afford to lose a year. I say we, the people of the state of North Carolina, whose interests have been established by the legislature in creating an urgency towards decarbonization. We can't afford to lose that year. We will also increase costs, and I think there's no question that delaying this further will further increase the costs. It also, I would submit to you, said that these state jurisdictional projects, two-thirds of what's in the transitional cluster now, may not come into DISIS as state jurisdictional projects bearing their own costs. So you may be looking at a situation with DISIS where all of those costs are going to be borne by ratepayers, because everything that is in that future procurement is going to be procured pursuant to 951.
And just to follow up on 951, if we proceed as you envision with two silos of competitive procurement and a CPRE-like process, we'll have an approved carbon plan by the end of next year. We'll start DISIS January 1st, 2023, and we'll probably have a lot of projects coming in, right?
Well, for the DISIS study is going to start in the middle of 2022, I believe. But if what you're saying is that there are going to somehow be a lot more projects, one of the things that is a consideration here, and I think Duke spoke to this in their comments in the Frisian proceeding, is that it would be a whole lot easier from a study standpoint to take these 65 projects that are there now, get them studied, get them processed and moving through to interconnection agreements, and then deal with whatever's coming in, then starting over, losing all the benefit of transition cluster, starting over and having a DISIS cluster that consists of 200 projects. That is going to be a massive undertaking for Duke to study. And so I think getting this study done now, getting us on the path to getting whatever upgrades you call for done now, greatly facilitates not only 951 implementation, but the successful implementation of DISIS going forward.
That's all my questions.
Ms. Cameron.
Mr. Levitas, I want to follow up on two lines of questioning. The first questions came from both Commissioner Clyde Belter and Commissioner Dopley. And it relates to, I think, one of the initial questions that Commissioner Clyde Belter asked about, I think he said, wouldn't it be better to wait to issue the CPCN until after the phase one results are provided? And your response, part of your response, was about the narrow window of 30 days between phase one and having to pay security for phase two. And can you provide any information about whether you think it's feasible or problematic to be able to obtain a CPCN within a very short 30-day period?
Well, I don't have all of the timelines in my head of the commission's CPCN rules. But just off the top of my head, I don't see how it is possible. And also keeping in mind that there's some lag time, maybe Ms. Miller could speak to it, between the time that we would get a decision and all the things that we'd have to be doing to secure financing and making arrangements to participate in phase two, because we will have to make a significant posting. So it just seems like an extraordinarily tight time frame, and I'm just not sure from the commission's standpoint how they make that decision. You know, is there going to be further proceedings? Is there going to be opportunity for hearing? it seems incredibly compressed.
Ms. Millard, were you wanting to add something about the financing aspect?
Yes, just to, for some further color, like you mentioned, it would be probably $2 million at a minimum and $5 million at a maximum that we would need to prepare to post within that 30-day period. And given the size of that deposit, we would need to be engaged with our, you know, financing parties, development lender, well in advance of that date and team them up to pay that. So I do agree that it's a very compressed timeline.
And Mr. Levitas, my last question, I'll go ahead and ask you to expedite this, to look under tab 7 of the notebook that I had prepared, and on page 9, and this is the public staff's response to Juno Solar's data request number 1.
Okay.
And this is following up, my question follows up the questions that came from Commissioner Duffley about whether you had any thoughts about whether there is another test that might be reasonable to assess the reasonable of network upgrade costs. And do you recall that we provided to the public staff question number 20, in which we tried to obtain information about whether any other state commission has utilized a test in addition to or other than LCOT. Do you recall that question?
I certainly see that question.
And can you describe to the commission what we learned from the public staff's response?
You want me to read the response?
Please do.
To Funny. No, the public staff is not aware of any other tests used by other state commissions. We also have not done any search or survey of other state commission approaches. The commission authority to grant or deny specific to state law GS-62-110.1.
Okay. And is that consistent with your understanding of law in other jurisdictions as well?
Well, I too have not done a survey, but I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction that uses a different test.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions that I have.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Levitas before we allow him to be excused? Seeing none, you're excused.
Thank you very, very much for accommodating my schedule. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay, now we'll turn to commission questions for Ms. Miller.
Just one or two for you. You testified today about the CNI demand and PJM for renewable energy. Talk a little bit about what you mean by demand for renewable energy. I mean, the transactions being entered into between a solar generator and a CNI customer that's located somewhere within the PJM footprint. It's not a power sale arrangement, is it?
It could be a physical power sale arrangement or a virtual power sale arrangement. In either case, it represents a physical need for power of renewable source. Even if not being directly delivered by the facility itself, they would just procure that energy on the open market where they're located.
Okay. But the customer would still be taking power from whatever load serving entity serves it, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And so when you say there's demand for this type of product, it's sort of, what do you mean? Help me understand what you mean by demand.
Sure. So we're seeing a lot of large commercial industrial customers increasingly create their own carbon reduction goals or renewable goals in the pursuit of their own, you know, environmental and sustainability goals. So that is driving a lot of increased interest in contracting directly with renewable facilities and especially solar plus storage facilities.
Okay. So a solar generator that enters into a contract, as you've described, with a CNI customer, would that solar generator also participate as a seller in the PJM energy market?
They
generator, I'm sorry.
Correct, they would.
Okay. And what about would the generator be able to participate in the capacity market?
They could for a facility like Juno Solar that is wheeling power to PJM. There is kind of a two-part wheel required to participate in the PJM capacity market. So we would not only need to procure firm point-to-point from DEP to the PJM interface, but also firm point-to-point transmission on the PJM side of the system. So there is an opportunity for a facility to participate in the capacity market at PJM.
Okay. I have nothing further. Thank you.
So when was the Juno project first initiated? I don't mean the CPCN, but when was it first envisioned?
So Juno Solar was formed, I believe, in October of 2020 and entered the queue at the end of the year in 2020.
Thank you. So you mentioned that the Juno project's one of the most cost-effective options for Duke to achieve its compliance with House Bill 951, but you're in negotiations with a PJM off-taker. So how do you square that statement, I guess?
Correct. I think with any facility, we always look for offtake optionality and where there are different cases of need. So with Juno, we currently intend to pursue, initiating a transmission study, continuing discussions with that PJM offtaker, but a lot of that will largely depend, of course, on the interconnection study results as well, since a lot of those power contracts carry very significant financial security. So we don't anticipate signing a contract in the very near future for the sale of energy from the facility, I should say. We would explore concurrently a potential sale via House Bill 951 with Duke as an option. In likelihood would initiate those discussions or participate in any procurements that occurred in 2022, if not already contracted.
Have you already started those negotiations with Duke?
We have had very preliminary discussions with Duke at this point.
Thank you. In your direct testimony on page 15, you mentioned Level 10 Energy, which provides insight into renewable PPA pricing. And you state that it notes that PPA prices in PJM are increasing because, there's a list. Number one is more challenging local and state permitting regimes. Which states and localities is that referring to?
So PJM primarily has a lot of supply from Virginia, Pennsylvania, and those states have generally less land availability and produce smaller size solar facilities and have more of an uphill battle as it pertains to zoning and permitting, which often cuts off supply from projects that could otherwise move forward.
And are there any other issues?
And as it relates to permitting, I think that's the primary concern, is that it's challenging to find projects of a significant size that carry cost efficiencies and economies of scale, and difficult to get projects approved as well to be able to meet that demand.
Then the second point was it mentions prohibitively high grid upgrades, and then the report goes on to say that the PJM market is short on solar project supply. What's the time frame when solar projects will be built within the PJM footprint, or is that really not an option?
So PJM projects are studied in a cluster process, just like Duke is initiating. So there are kind of waves of projects that are able to proceed through that process and be built. I think the issues that persist in PJM are not expected to diminish. There is also a active stakeholder proceeding occurring with a key reform of its own, if you will, for PJM's interconnection process that has expected to backlog projects really throughout this decade for new projects being able to come online if they are not already in receipt of an interconnection agreement.
And so, but in your opinion, do you see utility scale solar as viable in the PJM footprint?
I there is certainly utility scale solar, I think, being developed in the PJM footprint. But the question is there enough of it to meet the demand that is continuing to increase, whereas supply is continuing to be constrained?
Okay, thank you for that. And then the one staff question, I don't understand this, but they do. How will the facility be designed to ensure that the storage component does not take power from the grid? If it does take power from the grid, the interconnection study would need to be conducted twice, once in the facility as a generator and once as a facility as a customer. What's your response to that?
So the solar component of the facility is a closed loop system, meaning it's a DC coupled system. So it is designed only to charge from the facility itself and not to charge from the grid. And it's our understanding that Duke does not allow storage as it currently stands connected to a facility to charge directly from the grid.
And actually, I do understand that. You had a further question?
Well, I had a line of questioning that I wasn't going to pursue, and then you sort of got into it, so I have to ask. It's a quasi-rhetorical question, so you don't have to answer if you don't want to. But if you have a comment in response to it, you can, and I'd be interested in your comment. So I'm hearing that it's really critical that we resolve the problem of transmission constraints in southeastern North Carolina, which includes Richmond County, because it's going to be critical to our ability, absolutely essential to our ability to meet the goals of House Bill 951, that we be able to aggressively develop solar projects in southeastern North Carolina. They're the best locations. So here I have one of my best locations to meet my state policy goals, and it's going to be selling into the PJM market. What am I supposed to do with that fact when making a decision about public convenience and necessity?
Well, I think the facility still has a strong opportunity to be sold to Duke. So I would say that, as we've mentioned throughout the hearing today, that is still absolutely an option for the facility.
I understand you, and I take you at your word, and I don't doubt you for 1 minute. I'm really, as I say, quasi-rhetorically suggesting that the problem of optionality is not just in this case, we're seeing it constantly. And optionality presents us with a different, difficult situation. Suppose we were to find in one case that there is no showing of need, but there is a showing of need in the other case, mm-hmm. and for the other option. How should I deal with that in making a decision about whether to issue a CPCN mm-hmm. when the optionality is still open and not yet closed?
Sure.
Don't answer that. I don't expect you to answer that. It's simply a policy issue that we have to grapple with.
Sure. Yeah, it's a complicated question. I will share that the thing that makes Juno Solar unique from other solar assets located in Dominion territory in North Carolina is the benefit of the wheeling revenues that Juno will be paying to Duke's transmission system. And as we've mentioned, that revenue, in all likelihood, all of the dollar figures we've quoted are, I would say, quite conservative, because we are likely to also reserve non-firm transmission on top of whatever firm transmission we reserve. But are you know, substantial, and a substantial benefit to Duke's system and to the transmission grid. And of course, there's also the likelihood that if the facility has some sort of contracting arrangement in PJM, because it's physically located in the Duke system, the firm transmission service is a minimum of 1 year and a maximum of 5 years. So there is optionality within that to you know, to design the length of the contract and the length of the firm transmission to have the ability to serve the Duke system more directly in the future.
Thank you. Well, I wasn't going to even start down the road, but I don't have anything.
Commission, questions on commission questions?
Just a few. First of all, you mentioned the battery that'll be go along with the Juno facility. Has the battery entered any kind of study process?
The battery is included in the interconnection queue position with Juno. Because it is DC coupled, they can be studied as a single facility.
Okay. And you talk about when Chair Mitchell mentioned the CNI demand for renewable energy in PJM territory. Where is the majority of that demand within the PJM territory?
I don't know that I can speak to that directly, but I think the demand is across PJM more broadly, but I would say Virginia and Pennsylvania, which of course are extremely close to North Carolina, is where a lot of the demand is occurring.
Thank you. You spoke earlier about the timelines for the Wheeling transmission study, or you spoke of a Wheeling transmission study. Do you know what the timeline for that study?
Yeah, so as we understand it, so we've spoken with Duke about this, their transmission team. The study itself is in some way tied to the interconnection process. So in any event, we expect that the transmission study will be complete prior to the end of the actual interconnection study process, but it will have some connection to that.
And then my last question is just as we talk about wheeling power from this facility into PJM territory, do you know if that will have any effect on the current affected systems issues that we are seeing in the northeastern part of the state?
I believe we've looked at, again, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I believe we've looked at this and we don't believe that it's going to impact that specific issue. But of all the potential affected systems that Juno could trigger, because it is, you know, importing power into PJM, it is most likely that it would be identified that there is potential PJM affected systems. And actually, I'd like to point to, I believe in one of our data requests, we had addressed this based on our injection analysis. And I'm happy to point it out in a minute. All to say, I believe we concluded somewhere in our data responses that although we expect, oh here, okay. I'll just read it if that's okay.
Yeah, if you could identify which request.
Sure, so this is data request number two. Data request number two, question number 12A. And there, it says, please provide documentation that ensures that this project is not triggering any affected system study, utility studies. And our response was, through the course of Birch Creek's injection study, all tie lines to neighboring utilities were monitored for potential overloads, and none were found due to Juno's power flowing into adjacent systems other than PJM. It should be further noted that these potential violations delivering power into PJM are triggered by three natural gas projects amounting to over 4 gigawatts within a 5-bus radius of an area tie line between DEP and Dominion Virginia Power in PJM, with Juno minimally contributing to and not causing the potential violations.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all. And just so to make the commission aware, that data request response she is referring to is within public staff Miller Cross Exhibit number two.
Thank you. Come on. And briefly, Ms. Miller, in response, Commissioner Klagfelter
had asked you a question about the public convenience if Juno Cellar is selling into PJM, and you provided some information about the uniqueness of this project selling in into PJM due to the transmission payments to DEP.
Correct.
Is that right? Are there, assuming that Juno Cellar does sell into PJM, if it facilitates the upgrades in southeastern North Carolina, will there be any benefits to the state and to the ratepayers for compliance with House Bill 951?
Absolutely. So, as we've mentioned several times throughout the course of the day, we believe that the Juno facility is critical. It's a critical component of unlocking the logjam, as we say, in the southeastern portion of the state, where we believe much of the new solar generation could come online in the most cost-effective way to meet the goals outlined in House Bill 951.
And my last question, Ms. Miller, is in response to a question from Mr. Josie about affected system upgrades. Can you tell the commission about the condition that Juno Solar is willing to agree to in regard to affected system costs?
Absolutely. So in our, I think it might have been my rebuttal testimony, in my rebuttal testimony, we agreed that the $4 LCOT cap would be inclusive of any system upgrades and any affected system studies that would impact North Carolina ratepayers. So that would be inclusive in that $4 LCOT request.
And following up on that, Ms. Miller, was there another condition related to an agreement by Juno Solar about seeking reimbursement for affected system costs?
We agreed not to seek reimbursement for any affected system costs that would impact North Carolina ratepayers.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions that I have.
Okay, thank you. I believe that ends your case.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
I'll take a motion from public staff regarding the cross exhibits.
Yes, I move to have our cross exhibits 5, public staff, Levitis cross exhibits 1-5, and public staff Miller cross exhibits 1 and 2 moved into the record.
Any objection?
No objection.
Without objection, so moved. So we have come to thank you very much. You may step down.
Thank you very much.
So it is a little past 1:30. Let's adjourn for lunch. Let's come back at 2:05. Please go off the record.